Speech or Document 12. Division of State and Federal Powers. From an address delivered October 4, 1906, at the dedication ceremonies of the new state capital, Pennsylvania, in Harrisburg. I do not, however, come here today to speak only of the past, and still less to appeal, merely to state pride. We can show that the past is with us a living force only by the way in which we handle ourselves in the present, and each of us can best show his devotion to his own state by making evident his paramount devotion to that union which includes all the states. The study of the great deeds of the past is of chief avail in so far as it incites us to grapple resolutely and effectively with the problems of the present. We are not now menaced by foreign war. Our union is firmly established. But each generation has its special and serious difficulties, and we of this generation have to struggle with evils springing from the very material success of which we are so proud, from the very growth and prosperity of which, with justice, we boast. The extraordinary industrial changes of the last half century have produced a totally new set of conditions, under which new evils flourish, and for these new evils new remedies must be devised. Some of these evils can be grappled with by private effort only, for we never can afford to forget that in the last analysis the chief factor in personal success, and indeed in national greatness, must be the sturdy, self-reliant character of the individual citizen. But many of these evils are of such a nature that no private effort can avail against them. These evils, therefore, must be grappled with by governmental action. In some cases this governmental action must be exercised by the several states individually. In yet others it has become increasingly evident that no efficient state action is possible, and that we need, through executive action, through legislation, and through judicial interpretation and construction of law, to increase the power of the federal government. If we fail thus to increase it, we show our impotence and leave ourselves at the mercy of those ingenious legal advisers of the holders of vast corporate wealth, who, in the performance of what they regard as their duty, and to serve the ends of their clients, invoke the law at one time for the confounding of their rivals, and at another time strive for the nullification of the law, in order that they themselves may be left free to work their unbridled will on these same rivals, or on those who labor for them, or on the general public. In the exercise of their profession and in the service of their clients these astute lawyers strive to prevent the passage of efficient laws and strive to secure judicial determinations of those that pass which shall emasculate them. They do not invoke the Constitution in order to compel the due observance of law alike by rich and poor, by great and small, on the contrary, they are ceaselessly on the watch to cry out that the Constitution is violated whenever any effort is made to invoke the aid of the national government, whether for the efficient regulation of railroads, for the efficient supervision of great corporations, or for efficiently securing obedience to such a law as the National 8-Hour Law and similar so-called labor statutes. The doctrine they preach would make the Constitution merely the shield of incompetence and the excuse for governmental paralysis. They treat it as a justification for refusing to attempt the remedy of evil, instead of as the source of vital power necessary for the existence of a mighty and ever-growing nation. Strong nationalist though I am, and firm though my belief is that there must be a wide extension of the power of the national government to deal with questions of this kind, I freely admit that as regards many matters of first-rate importance we must rely purely upon the states. For the betterment of present conditions, the several states must do their duty or our citizenship can never be put on a proper plane. Therefore I most heartily congratulate the people of the state of Pennsylvania on what its legislature, upon what its government, has accomplished during this present year. It is a remarkable record of achievement. Through your legislature you have abolished taxes, you have placed the offices of the Secretary of the Commonwealth and the Insurance Commissioner upon an honorable and honest basis of salary only by abolishing the fee system. You have passed a law compelling the officers and employees of great cities to attend to the duties for which they are paid by all the taxpayers, and to refrain from using the power conferred by their offices to influence political campaigns. You have prohibited the solicitation or receiving of political assessments by city employees. You have by law protected the state treasury from depredation and conserved the public monies for use only in the public interest. You have by law for the protection of the elective franchise made tampering with the ballot boxes and the casting of illegal votes so difficult as in all probability to be unprofitable. You have provided a primary election law which guarantees to the voters free expression in the selection of candidates for office. You have by law regulated and improved the civil service systems of your greatest cities, and, finally, you have passed a law containing a provision which I most earnestly hope will in substance be embodied likewise in a law by the Congress at the coming session, a provision prohibiting the officers of any corporation from making a contribution of the money of that corporation to any candidate or any political committee for the payment of any election expenses whatever. It is surely not too much to say that this body of substantive legislation marks an epoch in the history of the practical betterment of political conditions, not merely for your state, but for all our states. I do not recall any other state legislature which, in a similar length of time, cast to its credit such a body of admirable legislation. Let me, however, most earnestly urge that your legislature continue this record of public service by enacting one or two additional laws. One subject which every good citizen should have at heart above almost all others is the matter of child labor. Everywhere the great growth of modern industrialism has been accompanied by abuses in connection with the employment of labor which have necessitated a complete change in the attitude of the state toward labor. This is above all true in connection with the employment of child labor. In Pennsylvania you have made a beginning, but only a beginning, in proper legislation and administration on this subject. The law must if necessary be strengthened, and it must be rigorously enforced. The national government can do but little in the matter of child labor, though I earnestly hope that that little will be permitted to be done by Congress. The great bulk of the work, however, must be left to the state legislatures. And if our state legislatures would act as drastically and yet as wisely on this subject of child labor as Pennsylvania has acted within the present year as regards the subjects I have enumerated above, the gain would be literally incalculable, and one of the most vital needs of modern American life would at last be adequately met. So much for the state. Now for the nation, and here I cannot do better than base my theory of governmental action upon the words and deeds of one of Pennsylvania's greatest sons, Justice James Wilson. Wilson's career has been singularly overlooked for many years, but I believe that more and more it is now being adequately appreciated, and I congratulate your state upon the fact that Wilson's body is to be taken away from where it now rests and brought back to lie, as it should, in Pennsylvania soil. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He was one of the men who sought out the Revolution, in which he had served as a soldier, would be utterly fruitless unless it was followed by a close and permanent union of the states, and in the Constitutional Convention, and in securing the adoption of the Constitution and expounding what it meant, he rendered services even greater than he rendered as a member of the Continental Congress, which declared our independence. For it was the success of the makers and preservers of the Union which justified our independence. He believed in the people with the faith of Abraham Lincoln, and coupled with his faith in the people he had what most of the men who in this generation believed in the people did not have, that is, the doubt courage to recognize the fact that faith in the people amounted to nothing unless the representatives of the people assembled together in the national government were given full and complete power to work on behalf of the people. He developed even before Marshall the doctrine absolutely essential not merely to the efficiency but to the existence of this nation that an inherent power rested in the nation, outside of the enumerated powers conferred upon it by the Constitution, in all cases where the object involved was beyond the power of the several states and was a power ordinarily exercised by sovereign nations. In a remarkable letter in which he advocated setting forth in early and clear fashion the powers of the national government, he laid down the proposition that it should be made clear that there were neither vacancies nor interferences between the limits of state and national jurisdiction, and that both jurisdictions together composed only one uniform and comprehensive system of government and laws, that is, whenever the states cannot act, because the need to be met is not one of merely a single locality, then the national government, representing all the people, should have complete power to act. It was in the spirit of Wilson that Washington, and Washington's lieutenant, Hamilton, acted, and it was in the same spirit that Marshall construed the law. It is only by acting in this spirit that the national judges, legislators, and executives can give a satisfactory solution of the great question of the present day, the question of providing on behalf of the sovereign people the means which will enable the people in effective form to assert their sovereignty over the immense corporations of the day. Certain judicial decisions have done just what Wilson feared. They have, as a matter of fact, left vacancies, left blanks between the limits of possible state jurisdiction and the limits of actual national jurisdiction over the control of the great business corporations. It is the narrow construction of the powers of the national government which in our democracy has proved the chief means of limiting the national power to cut out abuses, and which is now the chief bulwark of those great moneyed interests which oppose and dread any attempt to place them under efficient governmental control. Many legislative actions and many judicial decisions which I am confident time will show to have been erroneous and a damage to the country would have been avoided if our legislators and jurists had approached the matter of enacting and construing the laws of the land in the spirit of your great Pennsylvanian, Justice Wilson, in the spirit of Marshall and of Washington. Such decisions put us at a great disadvantage in the battle for industrial order as against the present industrial chaos. If we interpret the Constitution in narrow instead of broad fashion, if we forsake the principles of Washington, Marshall, Wilson, and Hamilton, we as a people will render ourselves impotent to deal with any abuses which may be committed by the men who have accumulated the enormous fortunes of today, and who use these fortunes in still vaster corporate form in business. The legislative or judicial actions and decisions of which I complain, be it remembered, do not really leave to the state's power to deal with corporate wealth in business. Actual experience has shown that the states are wholly powerless to deal with this subject, and any action or decision that deprives the nation of the power to deal with it, simply results in leaving the corporations absolutely free to work without any effective supervision whatever, and such a course is fraught with untold danger to the future of our whole system of government, and, indeed, to our whole civilization. All honest men must abhor and reprobate any effort to excite hostility to men of wealth as such. We should do all we can to encourage thrift and business energy, to put a premium upon the conduct of the man who honestly earns his livelihood and more than his livelihood, and who honestly uses the money he has earned. But it is our clear duty to see, in the interest of the people, that there is adequate supervision and control over the business use of the swollen fortunes of today, and also wisely to determine the conditions upon which these fortunes are to be transmitted and the percentage that they shall pay to the government whose protecting arm alone enables them to exist. Only the nation can do this work. To relegate it to the states is a farce, and is simply another way of saying that it shall not be done at all. Under a wise and far-seeing interpretation of the Interstate Commerce Clause of the Constitution, I maintain that the national government should have complete power to deal with all of this wealth which in any way goes into the commerce between the states and practically all of it that is employed in the great corporations does thus go in. The national legislators should most scrupulously avoid any demagogic legislation about the business use of this wealth, and should realize that it would be better to have no legislation at all than legislation couched either in a vindictive spirit of hatred toward men of wealth or else drawn with the recklessness of impracticable visionaries. But, on the other hand, it shall and must ultimately be understood that the United States government, on behalf of the people of the United States, has and is to exercise the power of supervision and control over the business use of this wealth in the first place, over all the work of the common carriers of the nation, and in the next place over the work of all the great corporations which directly or indirectly do any interstate business whatever, and this includes almost all of the great corporations. During the last few years the national government has taken very long strides in the direction of exercising and securing this adequate control over the great corporations, and it was under the leadership of one of the most honored public men in our country, one of Pennsylvania's most eminent sons, the present senator, and then attorney general, Knox, that the new departure was begun. Events have moved fast during the last 5 years, and it is curious to look back at the extreme bitterness which not merely the spokesmen and representatives of organized wealth, but many most excellent conservative people then felt as to the action of Mr. Knox and of the administration. Many of the greatest financiers of this country were certain that Mr. Knox's Northern Securities suit, if won, would plunge us into the worst panic we had ever seen. They denounced as incitement to anarchy, as an apology for socialism, the advocacy of policies that either had not become law or are in fair way of becoming law, and yet these same policies, so far from representing either anarchy or socialism, were in reality the antidotes to anarchy, the antidotes to socialism. To exercise a constantly increasing and constantly more efficient supervision and control over the great common carriers of the country prevents all necessity for seriously considering such a project as the government ownership of railroads, a policy which would be evil in its results from every standpoint. A similar extension of the national power to oversee and secure correct behavior in the management of all great corporations engaged in interstate business will in similar fashion render far more stable the present system by doing away with those grave abuses which are not only evil in themselves but are also evil because they furnish an excuse for agitators to inflame well-meaning people against all forms of property, and to commit the country to schemes of wild, would-be remedy which would work infinitely more harm than the disease itself. The government ought not to conduct the business of the country, but it ought to regulate it so that it shall be conducted in the interest of the public. Perhaps the best justification of the course which in the national government we have been pursuing in the past few years, and which we intend steadily and progressively to pursue in the future, is that it is condemned with almost equal rancor alike by the reactionaries, the Bourbons on one side, and by the wild apostles of unrest on the other. The reactionary is bitterly angry because we have deprived him of that portion of his power which he misuses to the public hurt. The agitator is angered for various reasons, including among others the fact that by remedying the abuses we have deprived him of the fulcrum of real grievance, which alone renders the lever of irrational agitation formidable. We have actually accomplished much. But we have not accomplished all, nor anything like all, that we feel must be accomplished. We shall not halt, we shall steadily follow the path we have marked out, executing the laws we have succeeded in putting upon the statute books with absolute impartiality as between man and man, and you then resting in our endeavor to strengthen and supplement these by further laws which shall enable us in more efficient and more summary fashion to achieve the ends we have in view. During the last few years Congress has had to deal with such vitally important questions as providing for the building of the Panama Canal, inaugurating the vast system of national irrigation in the states of the Great Plains and the Rocky Mountains, providing for a Pacific cable, upbuilding the Navy, and so forth. Yet in addition to these tasks, some of which are of stupendous importance, Congress has taken giant strides along the path of government regulation and control of corporations. The interstate commerce law has been made effective in radical and far-reaching fashion, rebates have been stopped, a pure food law has been passed, proper supervision of the meatpacking business provided, and the Bureau of Corporations established, a bureau which has already done great good, and which can and should be given a constantly increasing functional power. The work of legislation has been no more important than the work done by the Department of Justice in executing the laws, not only against corporations and individuals who have broken the antitrust or interstate commerce law, but against those who have been engaged in land frauds. Scores of suits, civil and criminal, have been successfully undertaken against offenders of all kinds, many of them against the most formidable and wealthy combinations in the land. In some the combinations have been dissolved, in some heavy fines have been imposed, in several cases the chief offenders have been imprisoned. It behooves us Americans to look ahead and plan out the right kind of a civilization, and that which we intend to develop from these wonderful new conditions of vast industrial growth. It must not be, it shall not be, the civilization of a mere plutocracy, a banking house, Wall Street syndicate civilization, nor yet can there be submission to class hatred, to rancor, brutality, and mob violence, for that would mean the end of all civilization. Increased powers are susceptible of abuse as well as use. Never before have the opportunities for selfishness been so great, nor the results of selfishness so appalling, for in communities where everything is organized on a merely selfish commercial basis, such selfishness, if unchecked, may transform the great forces of a new epoch into powers of destruction hitherto unequaled. We need to check the forces of greed, to ensure just treatment alike of capital and of labor, and of the general public, to prevent any man, rich or poor, from doing or receiving wrong, whether this wrong be one of cunning or of violence. Much can be done by wise legislation and by resolute enforcement of the law. But still more must be done by steady training of the individual citizen, in conscience and character, until he grows to abhor corruption and greed and tyranny and brutality and to prize justice and fair dealing. The men who are to do the work of the new epoch must be trained so as to have a sturdy self-respect, a power of sturdy insistence on their own rights, and with it a proud and generous recognition of their duties, a sense of honorable obligation to their fellows, which will bind them, as by bands of steel, to refrain in their daily work at home or in their business from doing aught to any man which cannot be blazoned under the noonday sun.